Good morning. My name is Adrian, and I'll be your conference operator. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the Restructuring Protocol conference call. All lines have been placed on listen-only mode. Later, we'll conduct an interactive question-and-answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. You will hear a tone acknowledging your request and a prompt to record your name. If you would like to withdraw your question, please press star, then the number two. I would now like to turn the conference over to our host, Carol England. Thank you. Mr. England, you may begin.
Thank you. Good morning or good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the second ISDA market call on the settlement of restructuring credit events. I'm Carol England, Director at ISDA. On Thursday, June 18th, ISDA sent the term sheet for the implementation of auction settlement following a restructuring credit event to the membership, and we also made the documents available on the ISDA website. Last Tuesday, which was June 23rd, we held a market call focusing on the principles described in the term sheet, and the term sheet, the summary of the term sheet, and the PowerPoint presentation that we used last week together with the recording of that call last week are available on the credit page on the ISDA website, which is www.isda.org/credit. For the first part of today's call, we want to focus on the reasons why adoption of the restructuring supplement is needed for trades going forward and why adherence to the small bank protocol is important. We'll first get a view from the supervisors, represented by David Bailey, who is a manager of the capital markets team at the UK FSA, and Theo Lupke, who is a senior vice president at the New York Federal Reserve Bank. Following the remarks from David and Theo, we'll have a brief possibility for Q&A. Both David and Theo will have to leave at about 20 past the hour, so people have questions. If they could key them in during their presentation, that would be very helpful. Following David and Theo, we'll have Athanasios Diplos, who is a managing director at Deutsche Bank, and Jonathan Adams, who is a managing director at JP Morgan, talk about the business drivers for adherence to the restructuring auction settlement protocol or the small bank protocol. And then in the second part of the meeting, we will basically open it up for Q&A, following up on any questions people have following the presentation last week and the principles as they are laid out in the term sheet, and obviously also any other questions people would have on any of the business drivers as discussed by Thanasis and Jonathan. So with no further ado, let me turn it over to David Bailey from the FSA. David?
Hi, thank you very much. Just to my name is David Bailey, and I'm speaking today on behalf of the UK FSA. We have been heavily engaged with ISDA and the market for many years now on operational enhancements to the OTC derivatives market, and therefore we are following the engagement with respect to firstly the big bang and latterly the small bang with great interest. One thing I should state up front, and obviously I'm speaking from a UK perspective, but I just want to make it clear that adherence to the small bang is not a regulatory requirement within the UK, but it is something in which we are taking a great interest, and we do feel it is important that all market participants review the terms and consider the implications and the impact that signing up would have on themselves, and give serious consideration to signing up and participating within the protocol. We are very much of the view that the small bang, especially from a European perspective, will contribute greatly to reducing operational risk once it's been implemented. It will be a great step forward in increasing standardization in contract terms, which has been a great focus of both the regulatory and political community over the over recent weeks and months, and importantly, the small bang will also go some way to facilitating central clearing for CDS, and therefore, from a UK FSA perspective, we would strongly encourage ISDA members to take a good look at the term sheet, understand what the implications are for your own business model and the derivatives transactions that you partake in, and give serious consideration to signing up. That really was everything I was going to say at this point in time before handing over to Theo, and then as has been said, we'll be online for a few minutes for questions. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, David. This is Theo Lupke from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, and I would like to reiterate the points that David made, but from the United States perspective, you know, we're certainly following not only the small bank, but other efforts that have been afoot to increase standardization in the market, as well as to build towards central clearing for as much of the market as possible. The small bank will certainly help lay the foundation that will enable central clearing to take place over the next couple of months in Europe. There's also a benefit for the small bank in the United States in that legacy trade with Mod R will be incorporated in that, so it's not just an issue for European trades or for going forward. It helps to address some of the legacy issues in the U.S. that were not addressed with the Big Bang a few months ago. And in addition, if there are firms that were not able to sign on to the Big Bang because they hadn't been able to engage quickly enough and get the paperwork done on time, adherence to the small bang will also give you adherence to the Big Bang, and this is the final opportunity to adhere to the Big Bang. So it's, you know, there's more complexity and subtlety to what's going on than just meeting the needs of the Mod R trades in Europe. And like the UKFSA, we certainly encourage all market participants to give very serious consideration to signing on and evaluating the benefits of the small bank. So that is all that I have to say before the questions. Let me turn it over to Carl for moderating the questions.
Okay. Thank you, David and Theo. So if people have questions, operator, if you could repeat how people should put in their questions.
Yes, sir. If you would like to participate in the interactive question and answer session, please press star then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. You will hear a tone acknowledging your request and a prompt to record your name. If you would like to withdraw your question, please press star then the number 2.
Okay, and while we wait and see if we get some questions, just to reiterate the point again that Theo made, that adherence to the small bank also basically means that you adhere to the Big Bang protocol. So for those firms that have missed that deadline for Big Bang protocol, this is obviously the unique possibility to still sign up to the Big Bang protocol. With regard to the timing and the next steps on the protocol itself. So as mentioned last week, and as people could see, the term sheet itself is kind of an interim work product. The comment period on the term sheet closes on Thursday, July 2nd, so that's coming Thursday, close of business London time, so noon New York time. So any comments people have, they really should send them to ISDA or to Allen & Overy by close of business on Thursday. And then we intend to distribute the first draft of the protocol Thursday evening, New York time. So that would be the first public distribution of the draft protocol. Operator, did we get any questions?
Yes, sir. Your first question comes from the line of Lynn Schultz.
Lynn, go ahead. Can you please indicate also as well which firm you're from?
Yes, I'm from Schroders, and thank you very much for the conference call. I just wanted to know whether, really from ISDA, whether any steps are being taken at the same time as doing this small bank protocol to address concerns of investment managers that have been made to ISDA on adherence effectively to the protocol by investment managers on behalf of all of their funds under an ISDA and later added funds under an umbrella ISDA.
I understand that to be a more general question to sign up to protocols, is that correct, or is it specifically for the small bank?
specifically to the small bang and the big bang protocol. It's not specific to, sorry, it's not for protocols in general, because the treatment of the closeout amount protocol has been quite different. So it's very specific to this protocol and the big bang protocol.
Okay, is that maybe a question that we can come back to at the end of the call? Because I don't think it involves so much David and Theo.
That's fine. Carol, I could send you my questions that I have been sending in, if that would help.
Yes, that definitely would be helpful. Thank you.
Okay.
Operator, are there any other questions?
No, sir. There are no questions at this time.
Okay, so if there are no other specific questions for David or Theo, I would like to thank them. I think both of them plan to drop off the call, and then we'll hand it over to Thanasis and Jonathan to talk about the drivers from a business perspective.
Thank you.
Bye. Thank you. Thank you, David. Thanks, Theo. Thanasis or Jonathan, you want to go ahead?
Thanasis, do you want to address the clearing benefits? And I'll follow on with some general benefits in terms of exactly how the mechanism works.
Yes, I'll do that. I think both David and Theo obviously covered some of these, but I just wanted to reemphasize the importance of the small bank for clearing. Basically, either when we're talking about direct clearing member trading, i.e. dealers clearing, or indirect access clearing, i.e. buy-side clearing, it's going to be imperative for a party that wants to clear a transaction to have adhered to the small bank. Otherwise, effectively, the clearing houses would not be accepting a transaction that has MODAR or MODAR as a credit event without that protocol. So in order for parties to be able to manage that kind of basis risk, the adherence is basically almost not optional, and that's something we want to make sure that people understand, that, because the timelines are very tight, and they miss that they might not get the same chance to adhere as they're getting right now with the small bank. To me, that's the biggest driver, and at the same time, not only people would miss the chance to clear the transactions, but also, as you can understand, the existing transactions will become, by definition, less liquid, and therefore much more cumbersome to handle long term. Those are the two strongest kind of points for which participants have to really seriously look at this and try to do the due diligence over the next couple of weeks. That, I'll pass it over to Jonathan.
Sure. Thanks, Thanasis. I think that leads us nicely into, you know, generally looking at restructuring again, and reminding people of how important the restructuring trigger is in the European environment. We don't have a Chapter 11 equivalent in European jurisdictions. So unlike the position in the US, where restructuring activity is inevitably carried on through a court process, it gives rise to a bankruptcy trigger. Typically in Europe, that's carried on outside a court process, and so absent the restructuring trigger in the contract, the CDS might not provide an effective hedge in that situation. I think in the European context, again, it's slightly different to the US. Restructuring is an essential part of the contract to address arguments around what's been labelled the empty creditor, i.e. concerns that somebody who holds CDS is not incentivized to act in a rational manner in terms of the restructuring of a troubled company, because their concern is driven primarily by creating a bankruptcy trigger for their CDS contract. To the extent that we maintain restructuring as a standard contract, it ensures that creditors are able to act in an economically rational manner and make the right choices. Again, this is not an issue in the US because the restructuring activity is carried on through a court process. So in that environment, we already have a situation as well where CDS holders can do exactly the right and logical economic thing without worrying about the performance of the hedge. In terms of the protocol and the mechanism itself, I assume that not all of you will have had time to read this yet. Some of you may be reasonably fatigued by the amount of ISDA documentation that you've seen over the course of this year. I think it's very important to give people comfort that we've taken a great deal of care in designing this mechanism to preserve as far as possible the economic position that people had under contracts pre-small bank. We've done that by using this range of maturity buckets, which we fine-tune using a couple of features, including the rounding down convention, to ensure that if you do have a restructuring trigger, the obligations that your auction will be held in respect of are very close to what you could deliver through your contracts outside the auction process. We've also taken care to do things like maintain the ability of people to choose to trigger or not trigger, to the extent that people have concerns about the nature of a particular restructuring event and the recovery associated with that. Again, we've maintained the ability for people to physically settle through the auction by buying or selling obligations. So those of you who hold assets against your CDS positions should feel comfortable that, again, what we're doing is providing access to an auction mechanism that allows you to replicate that physical settlement process. And we've also included a series of safeguards which allow people to do things like move from one maturity bucket to another to the extent that an auction is not available, perhaps where there are very few contracts triggered in that bucket, or in that case to take the contract outside the auction process and physically settle. So a lot of the design work in this process has been associated with looking at your current economic position around the restructuring event and ensuring that by signing up to this, you're maintaining that economic position, and to ensure that by signing up, the benefit you're achieving is both having a clearable contract, but also being able to access that auction mechanism. I can't see any particularly rational reasons why somebody would not want to sign up. If you have a look through the term sheet, I think that will flesh out some of the points I've just made. But certainly we think it's a very, very sensible thing for people to do. That was about all I had to say, Carl.
Okay, thanks, Jonathan. So at this point, we'll open it up to second round of Q&A on anything that Thanasis or Jonathan have been saying, or more broadly, any questions people might have on the term sheet following the presentation last week. Again, the materials are available on the ISDA website if you go to isda.org/credit in case you want to see the presentation or you want to, at a later point in time, re-listen to that presentation from last week.
If you would like to participate in the interactive question and answer session, please press star then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. You will hear a tone acknowledging your request and a prompt to record your name. There are no questions at this time.
So while we give people a couple of seconds to put in questions, just reiterating that the next steps really are the close of the comment period on the term sheet, so people really should have a look at it, and if they have any questions, comments, they should make sure they get to ISDA/Novary by close of business London time on Thursday. And again, Thursday, late New York evening, we plan to distribute the first public draft of the protocol. The adherence period for the small bank protocol, to give those dates again, so the protocol will open on Monday, July 13, and close on Friday, July 24.
Excuse me, sir?
Yes.
We do have questions. Your first question comes from the line of Abe Sigluzzo.
Hello?
Yes. Hi, go ahead.
Okay. This is Ave Sciliuto from Intesa San Paolo, Milan. I would like to ask in principle if in case of restructuring event, each case the at least at minimum of one auction can be assured to be held. And the second question is, if the DC determines that a restructuring credit event has occurred, but no auction will be held, and no auction, it will be the DC in each case which determines the deliverable obligation if the deliverable obligation for settlement. And the last two questions are in relation with timing. Is it correct to say that the auction date will be about 62 days after the restructuring credit event has occurred, and that the DC for determining the deliverable obligation will have up to 4 business days before the auction date? Thanks a lot.
Okay. I can run through some of these. That's helpful, Carl. It's Jonathan.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you.
So in any given case, there is no guarantee that there would be an auction. But to the extent that it's a name that's traded in any material amount, it's very likely that there'd be an auction. So the threshold for any given maturity bucket is 500 contracts triggered, which is a pretty low threshold. Now, in a situation where we didn't make that threshold and less than 500 contracts were triggered, the extent that there are other reasons that meant that it still made sense to hold an auction, the DC may still resolve to hold an auction. It will be an unusually liquid aim that results in a no-auction type scenario. And in that case, the small number of contracts that had been triggered on that name could be physically settled outside the auction process. In terms of the deliverable obligations, so essentially the process provides that the DC will initially determine whether or not the restructuring occurred. Following that time, the DC will start to compile a list of deliverable obligations that apply to each of the available buckets. So you as a CDS holder will have an opportunity to review that list of deliverable obligations and determine whether or not you wish to trigger your contract and submit to the relevant bucket. So you have that information in front of you. In the event that insufficient numbers of contracts were triggered, the deliverables that are applicable to your contract will be governed by that list. Now, just to be clear, it's not certain that in every case you would always have access to those deliverable lists. If a name was triggered which really didn't trade at all, perhaps that process wouldn't run through to that point, that you should assume that other than for very liquid names, that will be the process. I think that was about all the questions.
I think there was one question as well on the timing.
Well, the auction is scheduled to occur, you know, something in the order of 62 business days, I think it originally was. That's not set in stone. The auction date keys off various earlier parts of the process. It can be pushed out in certain circumstances where there is a delay, but your working assumption should be that it is at about that point. The reason why the auction occurs some way out is primarily because it takes some time to compile the list of deliverables for the various buckets to ensure that people have the right information in front of them before the trigger period opens.
Right. I think it's important to emphasize that the determination committee has some latitude with the timings, because there have been cases that we had to move the auction closer, and as you said, Jonathan, there are other cases that we might need to push the auction date out for dealing with deliverable obligations.
Okay, did that answer the questions?
Your next question comes from the line of Thomas Bone.
Hello. My name is Thomas Böhm from LBBW. First of all, thank you very much for holding this electronic conference. I have two questions. First of all, what is the reason for the imbalance triggering of the buy and sell transaction? I mean, currently under Section 3.9, from my understanding, we do not have this difference currently in place. So why is this treated differently than under the option way?
Second question.
Did he have a second question?
Pardon me? This is the first question. The second question is, I'd like to say after this one has been answered.
Okay.
I didn't understand the first one.
Can you repeat that question on the trigger, please?
I mean, from my understanding, if I have two transactions placed, one a buy and one a sell transaction, and if I would trigger them both, then the sell transaction I could get delivered everything. I would fall in the auction with 30 years bucket, where the buy transaction falls in the bucket where my maturity relates to. That's my understanding in respect of this restructuring mechanism under the auction, right?
That's correct, but that completely mirrors what is currently applicable under Mod R and Mod R, in that if it's a buyer-triggered trade, the maturity limitation restrictions apply. If it's a seller-triggered trade, those maturity limitation dates do not apply to the bonds that would be deliverable. So that's not a change for purposes of the auction.
Oh, sorry, that was my mistake. Just a second question. I was just wondering whether this movement option might lead to a break of my hedges. Let's assume I have two trades, two sell transactions, each one with 10 million and one buy transaction with 20 million. Now the counterparty, one of the sell transactions, decides to opt for movement, but the other one does not. Then basically my hedge breaks up and I cannot trigger the sell transaction myself.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, I would move to the 30th bucket in that trade. Jonathan, question.
Jonathan, you want to take that one?
Yeah, sure. So in the transaction where you bought protection, let's say you triggered that transaction, and
yes. Your
contract sat, is that not the question? Your contract sat in a maturity bucket for which no option was going to be held. The seller of protection to you in that case has the ability to move that into the 30-year bucket, which is theoretically a benefit to you, so that's upside for you. You alternatively have no obligation at all to move your contract into a shorter bucket, but to the extent that you looked at the contents of the shorter bucket and made a determination that you weren't economically prejudiced by that, that's your option to move it into the shorter bucket to enjoy auction settlement. If you are concerned, you can elect not to do that and to settle your trade physically outside the auction process. So you can't be forced into a less advantageous bucket. Nobody can settle into a shorter bucket.
And additionally, you would still have the opportunity to submit a physical settlement request to the extent that you moved into a bucket where there was an auction in order to source deliverables to settle the trade that was in the bucket without an auction.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, and again, I think at this point, it's worth reiterating that the sort of functionality that we're talking about, like the movement option, for example, these are things that are designed to maximize the chance that you get an efficient settlement result through the auction. These are not things that operate, to your prejudice as a CDS holder. These are things which are beneficial in terms of functionality. It would be very wrong for people to think that, perhaps they're signing something here that, could force them to settle by reference to, shorter dated obligations or something like that. That's not the case.
Your next question comes in line of Christian Klim.
Hello, it's Klaus Dürfer and Christian Klim from Westerby. We have a couple of questions. Some are concerning the central clearing houses and the rules that concern to the ISTA contract, and also some are directly linked to what you send around. And first question to that context, on page 13, they're talking about what happens if a credit derivative transaction is assigned to a maturity bucket but no auction is held. And then if physical delivery is a fallback method, there's only one day time to deliver a notice. From our point of view, this is a little bit too short. That should be at least 3 to 5 business days that we have chances to handle that issue.
Just on that point, it's not one business day, though, following the announcement that no auction is going to be held. It's actually the business day immediately following the date that the final price is determined in any other auction that gets held. So you do have a little bit more time, and the reason why we've done that is so that for any physically settled trades using the fallback settlement method, we've tied in the timing for delivery of notices of physical settlement with any notices that get delivered under auctions that are held.
Okay. The next question, the 500/5 rule. In the case that you have a central clearer around and the trades or quite a lot of trades are novated to the central clearinghouse, I don't think that you then have 5 remaining parties with 500 trades. You only have 1 remaining party with a lot of cancelled trades due to the fact that they are netted before when they are traded. So I think you have to adjust that ruling in the context of the central clearer establishing them.
Tanasis, do you want to take that question?
Sorry. Yeah, I mean, the rule reflects obviously the current market. We have to look at that obviously in the future as transactions move into clearing. But depending on the number, as I said, what matters also is of course the kind of the number of dealers involved and the number of trades. Now the DC, even without changing the rules, the DC obviously has the option to conduct an auction even with a smaller number of transactions, so we're not restricted if suddenly everything gets netted very efficiently, but that number kind of reflects the current market reality.
Yeah, but that means for me you have to build in a change like saying 500/500 or if a central clearing counterparty is demanding that, something like that. And also regarding the central clearing houses, the participation bidder is only obliged to take on bonds in the amount you have a trade with him. But if the trades are gone to the central clearer, I don't have a relationship with my original counterparty, which is or might be the participating bidder. So that means I have, going forward with the central clearing houses, I have problems to find anyone who's a participating bidder in an auction I can give my bonds or my loans I need a physical settlement for.
No, that's not correct, because unless you're a clearing member, you're not facing the clearing house directly. So to the extent that you're going to a clearing member, you would have to give basically your order to a clearing member that's also participating bidder.
But he's not too obliged to take it. And the clearing houses, are not willing to participate on the auction.
No, that's correct. The clearing house will never participate in the auction.
Yeah.
They're always flat. But the clearing member to which you're clearing your trade is your actual counterpart in the trade, not the clearing house. Unless you're a clearing member, you're accessing the clearing house indirectly.
So in other words, if you're a customer in the situation where we have the central clearing party arrangement, you're actually trading with, say, Deutsche Bank, and then Deutsche Bank is the clearing member of the central counterparty. But that would mean that the existing definitions we have in the auction settlement terms about who is a participating bidder and who is a customer and how you submit physical settlement requests would still be the same.
But correct me if I'm wrong. If I'm a member of the clearinghouse, I pass on my I have the trades with the clearinghouse and not with the counterparties like Deutsche, Goldman Sachs, as before. So if I bought the protection, who should I pass my bonds on? I want to settle.
No, but that's why we're making the distinction. If you're a clearing member and you intend to be a clearing member of the clearing house, it's true that you're facing the clearing house directly.
Yeah.
But
who can I pass on the bonds then? If I bought the protection.
Let me ask a question. Is that your case now? Are you a clearing member?
Well, I think it will be the case going forward.
Starting from the end of the month?
So
no, later on, right? Much more in the future. I'm just asking because it may be a good idea, and the industry can sort this out, the DC and the other participants in the market over time. It may be a good idea to tweak the auction settlement terms to allow for physical settlement requests to come in through some other mechanism in that sort of situation that you're positing. We haven't done that yet because at least to start with, the people facing the clearinghouse will just be the same people who are the participating bidders now. But even so, I mean, there's nothing to prevent dealers from taking orders from customers that they don't actually have the trades with. And in fact, in the auctions we've had so far, I think that's happened quite a few times.
Yeah, I think, John, the reason that we had put that provision in the first place was that the only way that dealers could until now verify what trades the counterpart had was by only looking at their own book, and that's why we limited the order to the amount at which they had the trade with us. The extent that someone is a clearing member at the clearinghouse and that position can be verified, that all could be adjusted over it.
Okay, we have two quick further questions to the term sheet then. On page 5 of the term sheet, which deals with the optionality of movement of transactions, it's basically saying that either the seller or the buyer can execute an option, but the way the obligation or the movement of that option is pretty much, well, it sounds as if it depends on a bit of luck, who's going to deliver this notice first. I wonder whether this couldn't be a bit more specified, because it sounds as if this could lead to potential disagreement as to which way this obligation has been moved. And the second deals with page 10, where it sounds as if it's with regard to the relevant deceit has determined that the restructuring and then following that there's an auction. It sounds as if we still have to deliver notices of credit event notices, which I wonder why this is still necessary.
So the movement option, that's a simple first-in-time rule. And it's likely that one party or the other will think it's economically rational to exercise that option to settle the contract in a different bucket. In terms of technical precision around exactly which of those things occurred first, we just need to be diligent in terms of systems and monitoring exactly when that was.
But we could potentially talk about minutes here. I mean, this is probably about who's going to read this fax first.
Well, I don't think it's a race to get there first. So if you're it's important to understand that if you're the protection buyer, you were in a situation where you thought it was economically rational to move to a shorter bucket. Now, if the seller sends notice first, that provides a benefit to you. If the seller sends their notice second, you are left in the position that you wanted to be in because you were sending a notice. So we're not dealing with a situation where there's some disadvantage that accrues to you because two notices were sent at a similar time. At least you are left in the position you wanted to be, and at best you're left in a better position.
Okay.
And as for the second question?
So the second question was on that question on the delivery of the
credit card notice. The need around notices.
Yes, I mean, the purpose for the notice is purely because we've given the parties still the option of whether or not to actually trigger on the restructuring credit event itself. Even though a DC may have said that a restructuring has occurred, the parties still get to decide whether or not to trigger on that credit event or whether to retain the protection and wait potentially for a bankruptcy or failure to pay to come along at some point in the future on the same name.
So whenever there's a decision on the restructuring, we are not bound to this decision of the DC then?
You're bound by the decision that the event is a restructuring, but you're not required to settle that credit event.
Okay.
Unless one party sends a notice.
Of course.
Okay, did you have any further questions? Operator, do we have other questions outstanding?
No, sir. There are no further questions.
Okay, so let's wait another 30 seconds to see if anyone has any additional questions. So please put them in now if you have so. Again, the information that we have so far, so the term sheet, the summary, the recording of last week's call, and the PowerPoint are available on the website. We'll also make later today the recording from today's call available. And as I mentioned, as next steps, we really have the close of the comment period on the term sheet on Thursday. Thursday, close of business, London time. Late Thursday, we'll circulate the first public draft of the protocol. Again, that draft also will be made available on the website. And obviously, if people have questions after the call, they can contact either their contacts at ISDA or the people at Allen & Overy or any of the dealer contacts they have and they want to speak to. So, operator, did we have any additional questions coming in?
No, sir. There are no further questions.
Okay, so if there are no further questions, then I think we're at the end of today's call. I would like to thank the speakers, obviously David and Theo, who dropped off already, and then the other speakers, Jonathan and Thanasis in particular, but also the other speakers that spoke on the call. So that concludes today's call. Thank you.
This concludes today's conference. You may now disconnect.